Welcome back to Kultur, the show where we tour the different cultures Pierce's population has to offer and discuss what makes each cultural makeup unique. I'm your host, Shir Nakash. Today is Wednesday, March 15th, and it is 3 p.m. Joining me today is Communications Professor Jennifer Rosenberg. Jennifer Rosenberg has been teaching here at Pierce for 16 years and has actually formally taught me. So how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining me.
My pleasure.
So in my first semester here at Pierce, I took COM 122, which was an intercultural communications class you taught, and you said you still teach it. Awesome. So I've mentioned before on this show that the content we covered in that class inspired the topics of my radio show now. Can you tell me what does intercultural communication mean to you?
Well, what it means to me is basically it's this idea that when we get together and we interact with each other, we're bringing our cultural influences with us. And it's really about having different expectations and having different interpretations of what is appropriate behavior in any given situation. So I kind of feel like sometimes when we are judging other people, what we're really judging is are there norms or their value systems, and we think it's more like their character, but it's often a misunderstanding.
Okay. So can you share in a sentence or two what the class is supposed to cover, if there's anything additional?
Yeah. Well, we look at different areas of intercultural communication. So I start off the class, I basically divided by several different themes. And one of the themes in the beginning is looking at how we categorize people based on perceived social constructions like race and ethnicity, and that's one section. And then we get into taxonomies, which are how theorists divide people and how they try to group cultures and try to understand them. But I always tell my students there's sort of a hypocrisy involved, because you're saying don't stereotype, and then you're stereotyping, so you have to kind of always check yourself. And I try and give students an opportunity to look at these theories and critique them, and not just accept them as like, this is what's right. They're not right. They're just their ideas. And right now we're getting into gender, which sometimes people say, well, why is gender intercultural communication? Because it is, right? Talk about different expectations, right? And then the idea of gender has become, it hasn't become complex, but we now recognize it as more complex.
Not very black and white. It's kind of like a gray area that you explore.
And yeah, I'm looking right now at sort of non-binary spaces.
And obviously that fascinates me, and I want to go into that in greater detail a little bit later, but I kind of want to first backtrack a little and figure out how you got here in the first place. So did you always know that you wanted to teach communications?
No. I really wasn't sure. I thought I wanted to do broadcasting.
Broadcast. Interesting. Yeah. Here we are.
And then I'm really kind of more ironically introverted, which people don't always expect. So I just knew it wasn't the right fit for me. But then I started taking comm classes and I fell in love. So I very quickly...
The classes are what led you to
teaching it.
Absolutely. Where did you take these classes?
Sacramento State. It was my undergraduate degree.
Yeah. And you were in graduate school as well?
I took graduate school. I went to graduate school at CSUN.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay. So what were some of the challenges that you had in getting here?
Well, when you're trying to get a full-time gig at a college, it's a lot of what we call freeway flying. So at one time I was teaching at seven different colleges.
Seven?
Yeah, I don't recommend it. And also, in retrospect, I don't know if it's necessarily ethical, because you can't, for me personally, I couldn't really give each class the energy it deserved. So, so I was just trying to build up my career, and that's the way to do it. And people live like that for their whole lives. So I recognize my privileged space. I'm so lucky. 3.5 years out of grad school, I got hired here.
At Pierce?
Yes, full time.
How did that happen? What was the process like? Why did you want to come to Pierce, or who led you here?
I was already teaching here, and it felt like home to me. I grew up in Canoga Park, and close by, it just felt like home to me here.
You never learned here, right?
I did.
Oh,
you did? I did take some classes here, absolutely, yeah.
When was that? I meant when, like, graduate, undergraduate.
Undergraduate, yeah. Undergraduate. I looked at you, I'm like, the year? Should I say the year? I would. But
you can if you want to.
Sometime in the 90s. So, so yeah. So
Okay, so in the night you were here and you kind of knew the area mm-hmm. and it felt very familiar.
Mm-hmm. Felt okay. like home.
That's nice. And I'm sure now, too.
It is a second home. Absolutely.
Is the course in the material that you compiled, is that something that you did? Is it completely original ideas? Were you influenced by other authors or educators? How did that course come to be?
So Jolene Kester was my intercultural undergraduate professor, and later on she became the president of CSUN.
Wow.
So for a long time, it was my favorite class. So I really wanted to bring it to Pierce, and Professor Anderson felt the same way. So we worked on the course outline of record, which is not original ideas, because you have to have certain state requirements when you're writing a class. There has to be something uniform. Like if they're taking the class at West Los Angeles, they should be having somewhat of a similar experience at Pierce College. So it's not original. I mean, the interpretation is, but there's certain things that need to be there.
There's a little bit of overlap in between a class that you would take here in that name and a class that you would take in another college
There should be. Well, because you have state requirements. So you have to follow certain course objectives.
Okay. Well, that makes sense.
And they have to be approved by the state. So everything gets approved by the state.
What did you add that was your own? I mean, I know that it's a compilation of things that, you know, you've read or that you've seen or that have been taught to you. But is there anything that stands out as, like, I added this part of me?
No, that comes later. Like I said, there's certain objectives that you have to have. And so the interpretation of that, like, I think sometimes people don't include gender.
Okay.
And so, and some books don't even have gender. Like the book I'm working with right now, there's not a section in regarding gender. And so I added that. And the material, so maybe not the concepts themselves, but the material that you add to it is your own.
So certain elements of what specifically in different cultures you're focusing on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that makes sense. Who would you say influenced you in your teaching the most?
Probably Jolene Kester.
And she, you said that's the one who became president at CSUN?
Yes. She was the first professor that was interactive. And I realized, and one of the things I liked about the field is that most classes were that way, where there were discussions, where my opinion mattered, and the instructor looked at it as though learning was collaborative.
So it wasn't just like a someone standing in front of you lecturing.
Right.
You had a part in the content.
Right. And it's so funny. In the beginning of my teaching career, I think I concentrated so much more on worrying about my knowledge because it was an insecurity. I was 24 when I taught my first college class. So I wasn't serving students very well until I realized what I really enjoyed as a student, and then I started changing my teaching style.
That's so interesting. So you kind of took what you liked and tried to project that in your teaching.
Mm-hmm.
I really admire that. That's awesome. So in preparing for today's episode, I actually found the syllabus that you gave us for Comm 122 in the spring semester of 2015, which is when I took it.
Mm-hmm.
And you listed three student learning outcomes, and I'm sure that they've changed or like there's some kind of variation of them. But when I read them, the terminology gave me like this intense flashback.
Mm-hmm.
So the first SLO is that you wanted your students to learn to apply Hofstede's value dimensions mm-hmm. to a culture or co-culture. So mm-hmm. I have two questions there. First of all, can you explain the difference between a culture and a co-culture?
Yeah, co-culture really, a lot of people argue in the field that we should be using the word lifestyle.
Okay.
But the reason I don't use that word is because I feel like it takes away the idea of culture, that lifestyles are culture. Sometimes students walk into the class and they'll say, well, I don't have a culture. I'm just the typical American. But that's not true. Everyone has a culture. Usually that's because you're part of the mainstream culture. But there are hobbies that we have. There are things that we do that represent our culture that we don't realize, and they're not ethnically driven. Whereas a culture is ethnically driven. It's values, beliefs, and norms shared by a large group of people, but it's ethnically driven. Whereas a co-culture is a lifestyle that could be chosen.
So a co-culture, an example of that would be like a musician's mm-hmm. choice to play music?
Yeah, a musician is a co-culture. Being a musician has its own culture in itself. Being a student at Pierce College has its own culture. Sometimes people think that, you know, that might be extreme, but I think if you really look at the essence of the definition of what a culture is, there's certain norms that are shared within those groups, right? There's certain value systems that are shared and beliefs that are shared. So I feel like it does justify itself as a culture. It's just not ethnically related.
Okay, I can understand that. So different parts of your life that aren't necessarily something you were born into.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then, so the second part of that is, who is Hofstede?
Gert Hofstede is a social psychologist. He's Dutch, and he came up, and he's still doing research. So he worked for IBM, and he basically, through IBM, researched about 60 different countries and asked questions regarding value systems. So he came up with these dimensions. So, for example, you may remember individual versus collectivism.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the idea, do you come from a culture that is more focused on the self or the group? And this is not to say there's not a middle ground. There is a, there, in fact, he's very quantitative in the way he comes up with how to number. But it's a number system that's based on comparison. And, you know, Hofstede, it's worthy work. I mean, but you have to recognize that it's not perfect. When you're doing questionnaires and you're interviewing people, and if you're doing it in a group setting, their responses may be influenced by others, you know, but it's still interesting work to look at someone who took work from 60 different countries and evaluated that material and came up with this system.
60 different countries.
Mm-hmm.
How did he collect that information? Do you know? Did he visit?
I'm sure it's a combination of people working for him and visiting. And I mean, it's still going on. He just added a dimension in 2010.
So he's still alive and doing this work.
Still alive and doing this work, yes.
Have you ever attended a lecture of his or something like
that? No, but I'm going to email him because things have come up lately about his masculinity versus femininity dimension. And why does he call it that? Because he's basically, he's perpetuating stereotypes about what it means to be masculine and feminine. And so students were discussing that, you know, why are you calling it that? Why don't you just call it achievement versus nurturance?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to try and contact him and see if he responds to me or someone from his group.
Have you communicated with him before?
No, I haven't. It's funny. I never
have. That's interesting. Okay, yeah. Let me know how that goes.
Yeah, I think it's time.
Interesting. Okay, so that's Hofstede. And then another SLO that you listed was that you wanted the students in your class to be able to, and this is a direct quote, identify and demonstrate the significance of verbal and nonverbal codes in the role of cultural patterns. So that's a lot. What does that mean?
So let's start with verbal codes.
Mm-hmm.
Think about the languages that people speak and how that affects them, right? And their perceptions of the world, right? But there's codes in that. It's, you know, related to sound. It's related to vocabulary. And that affects us every day. And so I teach it, if you remember, I talk about, you know, phonology and the sound of words and vocabulary and idiomatic expression, which is a part of every language. But then I bring it to dialect, which I think is so important because regionally, it doesn't matter where you are in the world, dialects are different. And so people sometimes learn best by their own experience. And so people will talk about their dialects in class, realizing there's this standard, right, that we're supposed to be meeting, but that most of us don't speak the standard American English.
So there's like a formal English, and then there's the actual way we talk.
Mm-hmm. And I think as time progresses, we've become more informal. Technology, music, all has an influence on our language. And generational, it's different too.
Right, the way that my parents speak versus the way that I speak.
Mm-hmm.
So what are some unique examples of verbal or nonverbal codes that you've learned about that have surprised you?
I guess it's this idea that no matter what verbal codes we use, we change with different groups of people.
So can you give me an example of that?
So right now I'm speaking to you, and I'm speaking in a context that's academic. But if my best friend calls me when I'm walking out the door, I'll be like, hey, you know, it's just like that informality. But it doesn't mean that I have an identity crisis, that I'm like an inconsistent person. It just means that we subconsciously switch with different people. People of authority, we speak in a different way. People who are peers, we speak in a different way. And we're constantly switching subconsciously without even realizing it, right?
Right.
All day long.
And so the verbal and the nonverbal go hand in hand, right?
Well, there's people that say that 70 to 90% of our communication is actually nonverbal.
In what way? What do you mean?
Well, think about it. Like this idea that when I'm speaking, there's all this nonverbal communication, right? It's the movement of my face. It's the way my body is. There's all sorts of things. I just started using my hands. I just became aware of that. So all of those things are a part of my verbal message, right?
So even just if somebody is leaning forward or back, that kind of thing. And I've seen studies that talk about, like, when you're being interviewed, how that comes off.
Right.
So all of that is related.
All of that's related. And also, we should be aware also first, we look at other cultures, but of ourselves and what we present in those situations. Like, I know we can't use profanity, but there's this idea, and I won't say it, that people have resting blank face. You know what I'm talking about?
Right, yes.
So what does that mean? It's like your nonverbal message doesn't match your verbal message, or just the way you carry yourself. People think you're mad or you're aloof, right? This idea. But really, it's just that's
just your expression.
Your default expression, right?
Right. Oh, interesting. I didn't even think about that.
Mm-hmm. When I first heard that term, I laughed so hard.
RBS.
Yes, that's why I love teaching
Pretty
college.
Great. When did you hear it the first time?
I don't know, a few years ago.
Yeah, I think that's when it came
up,
more or less.
And I was laughing so hard.
So then the third last SLO that you had listed was you wanted your students to understand cultural, racial, and gender differences mm-hmm. in various contexts mm-hmm. and address discriminatory practices. So there were two different parts to that. And this is kind of a broad question. I'm sure that each of those subcontexts has many, many mm-hmm. different answers, but what are some examples of significant cultural, racial, and gender differences that you can think of? And you can focus on one or all three, whatever is easiest.
I always find race disturbing because it's really a social construction.
Right.
But some people don't believe that.
What do you mean?
Well, I think people think that it's actual science. There's science that actually, you know, makes sense. And so we fit people into categories. Because, I don't know, maybe it's human nature, but we seem to like to group people. Right? So who fits into those categories, right? And it's a privilege to fit into certain categories. So like specifically like the idea of Caucasian. Who is Caucasian? Caucasian is the Caucasus Mountains, which expand a huge region. So if you group a bunch of people into that category, you would find that they're very different. So if you really cared about people, you'd want to know about their ethnicity because that will tell you their values, beliefs, and their norms, and their perhaps some of their perspective. So I just feel like it's just such a broad grouping that's completely socially constructed and used to keep people in a disadvantaged position.
Okay. I mean, I can understand that. And I get what you're saying about the disturbing aspect of it. But the classes, I remember it was very personal. And that's something that you mentioned where you mm-hmm. said you tried to kind of adopt whatever you felt your teacher was doing to you. Mm-hmm. It required each of us to kind of look into our own ways of life mm-hmm. and explore our respective backgrounds. What do you identify as part of your culture?
Well, I'm kind of, yeah, personally, my culture is very mixed. I have a background that's some European, Middle Eastern, North African, but I'm already second generation American. So some of the culture has been changed, you know, over time, or, you know, like recently my grandmother passed away. So I don't have those connections. So, but I still feel strongly, like, I don't know, how do we end up being tied to a particular culture, especially when you have a mixed ethnic background? For me, I guess it was language. So my, some of my family are Sephardic Jews. So during the Spanish Inquisition, Jewish people were kicked out, about 200,000. And they went to various countries in the Middle East and North Africa. And so I've always felt very tied to that culture. The language that many of them speak is called Ladino, which is basically Jewish Spanish, which people think
Ladino. Interesting.
Which people think is crazy. So I don't speak it, and most people don't speak it in its pure form anyways. It's a dying language. But because I guess my family came to New York and there are so many Spanish speakers there, you know, the language sort of developed into more like Puerto Rican Ladino, you know? And so I feel that tie, that language gave me the tie to that culture. And sometimes fun things like food. And so that's where I feel strongly connected to.
Yeah, you said it's very mixed, but you also mentioned, and you said this earlier, that you're second generation American, and a lot of people, you know, a lot of times people say or they joke around that Americans don't have culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, do you agree with that? Do you think that that's a no? So why do you think that people say that there's no such thing as American culture?
Because I feel like it's like a comparison.
To what? You know?
Because we live in such diverse societies and you have other people and you see the difference. So you say, oh, well, I don't really have a culture because look at these cool Chinese people, or look at this, you know, my friend who's from Nigeria and their language and their food. And maybe it seems exotic to them. And maybe the truth is American culture is a mix of so many different things.
Right.
And it's also very regionally influenced, too. So It's just that we're so diverse. I think that's why it comes up, where other cultures are much, or other countries could be more homogenous, so it's clear to them.
Okay, that kind of makes sense. I mean, teaching here, you must have seen a mix of tons of different cultures in your class. And so what's a culture, I don't know if this has happened, but has it ever happened that you were introduced to a culture you didn't know existed?
Not in the class.
Not in the class. Were a student brought to your attention a whole culture that wasn't, you weren't aware of, or if not a, not a whole culture, then what about a cultural custom?
I was going to say like a co-culture.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think. I know I've been introduced to co-cultures that I've never heard of before, for
right.
sure, but like right now off the top of my head, it's not coming to me.
Well, it's okay. What about like a cultural custom that you didn't know existed or that people did? And this can come from, you know, a holiday or a superstition or...
Most of the things I'm familiar with, maybe sometimes we talked about, we had the activity today where people were, we were talking about gender, but I was asking them to name a practice or a policy in another country that's gender related and the effect on that gender. And this was something that I didn't know, that the student said in her country that women are not allowed to sing solos. They have to have a man with them.
Wow, which country was this?
It was Iran.
Iran.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah, I had never heard that before.
And I'm sure that happens all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not you've never heard it before, but that other kids in the class,
mm-hmm.
other students are suddenly aware of like, oh, wait, I didn't know that that was a thing.
The class is nothing without the students' contributions.
And one of the reasons that it had such an impact on me was that there were a bunch of really cool assignments that we were given. So you gave us projects that we had to complete outside the classroom, like required field research. So we had to go observe three different cultural events,
mm-hmm.
or locations or aspects, and only one of them could be a restaurant, which, mm-hmm. like, I remember the groan in the class was like, oh man, only one can be food. But how did you think up of this assignment?
Actually, it was really influenced. It was a modified version of Professor Kester's assignment.
So you had to do it too?
I had to do it too, and it was a little bit different.
Okay.
And I can't really remember. I don't think co-cultures were included in it. I've definitely changed it a lot over the years,
mm-hmm.
but initially there was something to that effect that I did in that class that influenced me so much that I feel like you could read about things, but if you don't experience them, it's not the same thing.
So you wanted them to go out and really like take part in something rather than just theorize about it.
Exactly.
Okay. And so we had to write about our experiences,
mm-hmm.
after we attended them. And what do you think is one of the most interesting events someone went to observe that you got to read about later?
Someone who came from a pretty conservative background and had very strict family in terms of, and their family, you know, had a lot of rules about what they were allowed to do, their perspective of a rave.
Of a rave?
Yes.
Which is a co-culture, I'm
right.
assuming?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And what did they say?
They just felt like it was just this crazy upside-down world that they could have even imagined. And there were aspects to it that made them very uncomfortable, but there were aspects to it that they thought were really amazing and beautiful. So the assignment is about stretching your wings, and it's very individualized. Like, people will come up to me and ask for my opinion on the assignment. And,
right, suggestions on what to go to.
But it's very individual. Like, what's intercultural for you might not be intercultural for somebody else.
Right, because we've all experienced different parts, depending
mm-hmm.
on friends. Yeah, okay, that makes sense. Do you have a memorable story of someone who shared how it's changed their perspective or taught them about other ways of living?
In terms of the class in general, or?
The class, the events, hearing somebody else's experience or the way that they grew up, you know. I mean, it's so diverse, and so that's kind of what I liked about it, is it was a combination of a ton of different people's lives.
Mm-hmm. I've had several students visit Narcotics Anonymous, and one student visited, they were sort of in a way part of the culture because they had a family member that was no longer present, but had a drug abuse problem, and they got to understand them from that perspective, which they never had that opportunity, and I think with that came forgiveness.
That's huge.
Yeah, huge. So I always feel like I always encourage, you know, pushing your limits, because people have these amazing moments. And sometimes there's pain and growth, and people try to avoid it. But again, like, that's an example of a beautiful moment.
Yeah. Wow. Well, the same way that you just said, you encourage your students to explore different cultures. Do you try to engage in and experience different cultures that aren't your own?
Whenever I can.
How do you do that?
It's good that I have a lot of diverse friends, so sometimes it's just through that. But if something comes up and I hear about it, I will do things that maybe would be uncomfortable for other people, like take part in a ceremony, not just as an observer, but sometimes I interact. I don't know if you remember, but I told the story of I had a shaman suck parasites out of my body. Do you remember?
No,
you
don't I don't remember that.
Yeah, I usually tell the story in class because I feel like, you know, if I'm going to teach this class, I got to have what I call street cred. And right? I mean, I can't just read about it, right?
Right.
I have to experience things.
Okay.
Otherwise, who am I to talk about this? So it was really out of my comfort zone.
I can imagine, having parasites sucked out of your
body.
And
he let me look in his mouth first, and I kept in touch with him a long time. He was a Mongolian shaman, and there were parasites in the cup. I don't know.
That's crazy.
Yeah, so I have to do things like that because I have to challenge myself. I'm challenging my students, and I have to rethink things all the time.
Why do you think exposure to different cultures is important?
Because I think it shifts perspectives.
Has it shifted yours?
For sure.
In what way?
I don't know. I think I grew up with diversity, but I really feel, if I'm going to be really true and honest and authentic, that there was still this self-segregation in my school system where people, like, I had friends from other groups, but people kind of hung out together in groups that sort of were more ethnically homogenous. And there was safety in that. Not to say that there weren't other friends, but I feel like that was more common than not. And so if you're only in this small little world, there's so many other things out there. There's things to learn. Sometimes it's just a simple realizing you like green eggs and ham. I mean, I don't mean that literally, but
right.
You know what I mean. Or that, you know, someone's perspective on relationships or friendships really actually suits you better than what you grew up with. And then you change your mind about things. I mean, for me, spiritually, what I was raised in and what I believe now, because I've been exposed to so many different religions, it's different, but I think it's a good thing.
I absolutely agree. I think if it doesn't change, either you're really set on whatever you were growing mm-hmm. with, or you just haven't been exposed to different things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why people travel. You know, they say they want to experience different culture, or come back more cultured. That's a big, mm-hmm. a big saying. So what's your favorite part of the class?
Like my favorite activity or?
Your favorite experience with the students. I mean, that can be anything. Them sharing, you hearing something, you talking about a certain part of it. What is it?
It's the discussion. Sometimes I actually feel stressed out because I have to go there. I feel like maybe I don't, but I choose to kind of push the limits. That's just part of how I am in the classroom. And so sometimes with that push, you get the responses and like I said, the responses from the students are everything. They are the class, really. I'm just a facilitator. And so you'll have these moments in discussion where someone will realize something and share and say, thank you for sharing. Or people are carrying things with them that they weren't able to share in other situations, but they feel safe to share it in that classroom. And I feel like that's the best part of that class.
Will you be teaching it next semester?
I am. I'm hopefully teaching it forever.
I mean, I strongly encourage any peer student who's listening who has not yet taken Professor Rosenberg's class to enroll for next semester, because I certainly got a lot out of it. I'm sure whoever takes it will too. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have today, but thank you so much, Professor, for joining our program.
Thank you for having me.
I really appreciate it. Tune in next week to hear all about Adi Lerner, an Israeli-American student here at Pierce who formerly served in the Israeli Defense Force, and will speak with us about Israeli culture. Thank you for listening to Kultur from kpcradio.com. I'm Shirin Akash.